Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this program, Medical News Debate Dialogue Discussion, and the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. There were a lot of interesting kind of background stories in the news today, and I thought I would lead with this one, which actually came through my regular doctor email from a local orthopedist. Thanks to Dr. Nicholas Abidi for giving me a heads up on this. I've had several questions over the last few months about long-term bisphosphonates. And these are drugs like Fosamax, which are used for osteoporosis. There have been some recent new findings which are not unexpected in the sense that when you give a drug for a long period of time, effects that take a long period of time to emerge are not going to be apparent until you've given the drug for a long period of time. And the latest stuff is worrisome, so I want a heads up for everyone out there who is on any of the bisphosphonates, and that would be drugs like Fosamax, alendronate is another one. And the reason this is important is because these are drugs that are widely given to both men and women, but especially women, for long-term osteoporosis. These drugs act on the bones by reducing bone breakdown, which seems like a good idea when bone buildup has slowed down, but they may work a little bit too well. In people who have been taking the bisphosphonates for more than 5 years, and I'm going to quote two studies here, one looking at people with an average duration of 8.5 years, and the other looking at people with an average duration of 4 years. In the first study, the patients had fractures of the femur, and these were unusual femur fractures, and that they occurred lower down on the leg. They're so-called transverse femoral fractures, not typically where the leg breaks. So that led to some concern that maybe we were altering the natural history of the bone. Indeed, we are doing that with bisphosphonates. And so in this first study, they did biopsies of people who had had fractures of the femur, and they looked at the bones under microscopes and found that the crystallinity of the bone was reduced about 30%, and that there was less heterogeneity. So in other words, the bone looked more boring, well, just more bland, less structure, less fine microstructure, less variation. And variation's probably a good thing in bone, probably helps prevent stress fractures and also probably helps diffuse forces as they move through the bones such that you don't get all the force concentrating in one area and causing a fracture. In a second study, 112 postmenopausal women with osteoporosis were biopsied. These were not people who had fractured. These were just people who had either been on bisphosphonates for at least 4 years or hadn't been. And what they found was that in the first few years that one takes a bisphosphonate, you have improved structural integrity of the bone, but that these benefits plateau at about 4 years. And as you get further and further out, 5, 6, 7, 8 years, the benefits reverse and you start to see structural changes that would lessen the stability of the bone. So what this has led to is a change in how we're going to be using bisphosphonates going forward. So if you're out there listening to the program and you've been on Fosamax, for example, for 10 years, it's time to take a drug holiday. And we'll probably be tracking people back and trying to locate and create drug holidays for people in order to allow the bone to actually break down some so that it can rebuild in a different shape and get that structural heterogeneity back, because we understand that to be very important. The fine microstructure of bone is very important. In searching for this article, I found all sorts of things on the web about, you know, Fosamax is going to rot your jaw, osteonecrosis, kill your kidneys, make you go blind. And these were extreme claims, and I wanted to track them down. So I found a really interesting review paper that was in the Annals of Oncology, volume 17, page 897. And this was looking at the intravenous bisphosphonates. all of these claims are associated with the use of intravenous bisphosphonates, which are not given for osteoporosis. They're given mainly for bone cancers that are metastatic from some sort of primary. There are a few other indications, but that's the main one. So if you are a person who has metastatic bone cancer and you are getting bisphosphonates, the risk-benefit ratio is very, very different. And while these side effects that are mentioned do all occur, you do have people who develop a problem with actual death of bone in their jaw, usually in the presence of existing bone disease and infection. Effectively, the infection goes rampant because the bone is no longer able to protect itself because the osteoclasts have been impaired by the drug. Other situations that occur are kidney damage. These can be quite serious in terms of the kidney. And you also often see up to 30 to 40% of people will have an acute inflammatory reaction as these drugs go through their body. So this is not a benign therapy, but it's also not a benign disease. And when you read about bisphosphonates, it's really extremely important to separate in your mind, is this being given orally or is it being given intravenously? And secondly, is it being given in a dose for cancer, in which case the risk benefits allow for more side effects, or is it being given as a preventative in osteoporosis, in which case we need to have a very different tolerance for side effects and risk? We're going to go first to Tony in Carmel. So welcome to the show, and what can I do for you?
Well, I have two things. First of all, I have a sinus condition that I just can't shake. It gives me a bad taste in my mouth, and I've tried all kinds of different things, and I seem to get rid of it. I've had it for months and months.
Months and months. Are you allergic? Do you have other allergy symptoms like sneezing or itchy, watery eyes?
No.
Do you live in a moldy environment?
I think that's very possible.
Okay. Well, first thing that one wants to do is try lavage. So that would be getting a neti pot, doing salt water lavages of your sinuses, using sea salt. Typically what I'll tell people is to do it twice a day.
Okay.
And it's important to lie down for a couple of minutes after you do the lavage to try and get the maxillaries to drain fully. If that doesn't work, then I have had some success with people with mold. And this is a complete off-label use. It has to be prescribed by a physician. So you're going to have trouble maybe finding someone who will do this. Someone in the natural world, naturopathic world, might be more likely to be able to do this for you. But there's a topical ketoconazole, which is an antifungal drug. And one mixes it up into a water solution and can spray it in the nose like a nasal spray. And enough of that gets up into the sinuses to inhibit the growth of mold. And that's my next step in people with chronic sinusitis. I also suggest looking at food sensitivities because sometimes it's wheat or dairy that's actually creating the mucosal congestion.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a bad taste in the mouth, that worries me that there's some sort of organisms growing up there. Of course, mm-hmm. they may be there because they're taking advantage of a favorable environment, which is being produced by some other cause.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes those chronic infections are really more like colonizations. It's like, hey, come on in, guys, the water's fine. And you have to get rid of the source of the backup, source of the fluid, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
We also had a reference off the air from my environmental expert friend. I should have suggested this myself to our caller in Carmel, which was to get rid of sources of moisture in the house to help eliminate molds. Like any other plant, molds require water. And when there is no water, they kind of dry up and go away. And most importantly, they don't reproduce, so they don't produce spores. And a lot of the gases that are produced by molds as part of their metabolism, well, those don't get produced either because the molds shut down their metabolism and go into a sort of suspended animation. So a very good way to keep your mold allergies down is to get rid of the mold. What was your other question?
The other question has to do with my fingernails. My fingernails, which are usually very thick and hard, have become, living in this particular house, very thin and not hard. They're practically like paper.
Hmm. Time frame for that?
I've been in this house almost 2 years.
Has your diet changed at all during that time?
I don't think so.
Okay. the most common cause for soft fingernails is vitamin deficiencies, and especially when it's a shift. I mean, some people have naturally, innately, because of their DNA, soft fingernails. And in Chinese medicine, that actually has significance with respect to what your energy patterns are. And that's a very useful diagnostic tool there. In conventional medicine, it has only this implication for certain nutritional deficiencies. And the top ones are zinc and biotin, B-I-O-T-I-N, which is one of the B vitamins.
Mm-hmm.
People who take alpha-lipoic acid, which is an antioxidant and often included in antioxidant formulas. I use it all the time for people who have neuropathy or who are pre-diabetic, will sometimes inadvertently deplete their bodies of biotin. So it's possible that one of the quote-unquote nutritional substances you might be taking could be impairing biotin absorption or causing depletion. I'm not sure what the mechanism is of that, by the way. So I would get on a strong B complex, not just pure biotin, but maybe a B100, which has double doses of everything.
Okay.
And you could have your doctor check a red blood cell zinc level and see if that is at the lower end of the range. If it is, then you should take some zinc, maybe a mineral formula. If you do take zinc, be sure you take copper, because they fight each other for absorption. And if you're taking a lot of zinc, you'll actually deplete your copper. And this is one of the lovely things that I've learned in all my studies in the last few years of nutrition, is that it's not all harmless. You can actually deplete one thing by super augmenting something else.
Mm-hmm.
I hope those are helpful for you.
Well, I hope so, too. How long should I, if I take the biotin or the B100, which I guess has biotin in it, how long before this changes?
It'll be about 3 months to grow out to the tips on your fingernails.
Uh-huh.
So I'd say about 3 months before you can really be sure that you've gotten to
it. That I've got it.
Yeah.
But that doesn't sound like a mold issue to you.
No, it doesn't. I'm not aware of any connection between the fingernails and mold. I mean, besides the fact that you can get fungus in your fingernails, but that doesn't make them soft. It makes them thick.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, that's interesting. That in itself is helpful.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to John in Carmel Valley. Hello, John. Welcome to the program.
Yes, doctor. Keep reading occasionally articles that directly implicate zinc into the formation of those amyloid plaques that cause Alzheimer's. There was one study they claimed in this article in Australia where they thought the zinc was so cause of increasing them that they discontinued the study. And this was some time ago. And every time I read something like that, it makes me nervous because there is, in my family, there's been a lot of Alzheimer's. So anything at all makes me uneasy. But I don't want to stop taking zinc because I read just as much, if not more, information saying that up to 50 milligrams is okay and maybe even very helpful. What do you think?
Well, the first thing, John, is I think you should be checked for the ApoE4 allele. And you can get that testing through most conventional laboratories now. And the ApoE4 allele, Apo, A-P-O, capital E, 4, numeral 4, is the gene that's associated with both Alzheimer's and some cardiovascular disease. But if you have two copies of that gene on your chromosome, then you have a much higher risk for Alzheimer's. And all of the precautions that are suggested probably apply most to you. Now, in terms of whether zinc is a cause of Alzheimer's, I'm always very nervous about the use of the word cause. I think we could prefer trigger. And whether it triggers Alzheimer's or not probably has to do with, among other things, your DNA and whether or not the gun is loaded, so to speak, in terms of developing that disease. There is a study looking at, the laboratory study, looking at beta amyloid in the cerebrospinal fluid. Beta amyloid's a protein that if it twists in a certain way, it cleaves improperly and becomes this plaque. The zinc in the study was added to the cerebrospinal fluid and did cause more clumps to form that looked like the Alzheimer's plaque. I'm not aware of a human subject study that did that, and I'm wondering how on earth they could possibly do it. and show that zinc caused increased plaques, because you'd have to actually do brain biopsies on people to see the plaques. So if you have any more information about that study in terms of a reference or the name of the chief author, I'd really appreciate your sending that to me at the Ask Dr. Don website so that I can follow it up. But off the top, I'm like, I'm not sure how they could be measuring it. So I can only comment that, I wonder how on earth they did that study, and maybe they had some kind of surrogate measure of Alzheimer's, at which case, how good is the surrogate measure? You always worry when people stop a study, but I'm having trouble with the comment. Too little zinc is also maybe a problem. People with Alzheimer's disease who die when they do autopsies of their brain, they find that some regions actually have very low levels of zinc, not an accumulation as you might expect. But then maybe that has nothing to do with it. Maybe it's not the accumulation of zinc, but it's the zinc triggering some kind of intrinsic problem with an enzyme that's supposed to cleave the beta amyloid and then doesn't cleave it. So I'd say it's a big fat question mark. And your best bet is probably not to take high levels of zinc, but to take kind of stay on the low side and get that ApoE testing. So let me just look up. I don't have zinc in my brain in terms of what the recommended dosage range is. But you might want to just get a serum zinc testing. There are two tests that you can do. One of them is just get a blood level, like a red blood cell zinc that I mentioned, and make sure that that's in the normal range. That's easily done, and you can get that test from your doctor. And then the sort of recommended dose is 15 milligrams to prevent deficiency. So I think I'd stay at the low end on the therapeutic dosing range, which is 20 to 150. So, you know, stay at the low end, stay 15, 20, 25, rather than taking, 100.
Another question that's totally it might be distantly related, but you had said, I think a couple of years ago, that of all the environmental hazards that directly concerned people, maybe people in this area, was metals in water supply. Do you still feel that way, or are there other hazards that you see as greater? And if in that one, if you're still concerned about that, what is the source we're providing in particular that's creating these metals to build up? How could we stop it from happening, in other words?
Let me start by saying I'm not sure that was me, and I don't remember the context of the statement, if in fact I did make it. But the most worrisome environmental pollutant is obviously airborne, and it's cigarette smoke. I mean, that cigarette smoke and air pollution are really significant things, and I'm going to be doing a science lesson at the half hour about the lungs and talking about more about why that's the case. So I'll put a little preview there. But there's a lot of arsenic that comes in well water, and there are breakdown products of chlorination that come in tap water that's supplied by a central source, which are very problematic and possibly carcinogenic. And the best solution to that is if you're on a well and your water is not being processed, then you want to get it tested, and you want to get it tested for things like arsenic, as well as organic pollutants and nitrates, because that's another issue in our well water, and make sure that it's fine. And if it's not fine, then you're going to go to Plan B, and Plan B for all municipal water is to consider using reverse osmosis, which is a technology that purifies the water and removes almost all contaminants. Now, there's an energy cost to that, but I think it's certainly, at this point, reasonable to consider that that cost is just to be factored into keeping yourself healthy.
Your host moderator screener said that you were concerned about plastic. We shouldn't buy water in plastic bottles.
That's true as well. BPA, and we've talked about that so extensively on the program. That's a problem with trying to get away from the heavy metals and the arsenic and the chlorine breakdown products by going to bottled water. That's worse. Bottled water definitely is a problem if the bottle has BPA in it.
And most do, I would assume.
It has. You have to just look for the numbers, and we've covered this topic extensively already.
Okay.
It's okay. You can just go to the website though and search on that as a keyword, and you'll find lots of information about water and water safety.
Well, thank you very much. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Appreciate your program.
Thank you very much. So I had mentioned we were going to do a science lesson, and this was triggered by discussions this last few days in the news about the volcano in Iceland and that plume of particulates spreading out at 30,000 feet, grounding a lot of airplanes. It's such an interesting thought. And also the coal mine disaster, which happened this week, and the discussions that it generated with respect to coal mining in general and black lung in particular. So in an effort to improve your understanding of these issues, I thought we'd talk a little bit about the lungs today. First of all, you can't have a discussion of the lungs without talking about the structure. So I want you to visualize in your minds a tree with a lot of very regular symmetric branches. So a trunk, and then two main branches, and then each of those main branches separating off, and then two, then four, then 16, then 64, and just continuing to branch smaller and smaller and smaller in that sort of geometric progression way. Now make the branches hollow. That's the bronchial tree. And when we talk about this type of lung disease, the bronchial tree is really importantly where the action is. What the lungs do is very challenging. They have to get the actual atoms of oxygen, or I should say molecules, since it's O2, they have to get that out to a single cell layer that allows the oxygen to diffuse into the bloodstream. So when you really get down to the business end of the lungs, where the diffusion is occurring, you have an alveoli, which is a one-cell thick wall, and then you have a arteriole capillary, which is one cell thick wall. And the oxygen is able to move across those two lipid bilayers and get into the bloodstream, where it's immediately grabbed up by hemoglobin. And that's how we breathe. But along with the oxygen comes a lot of other things on for the ride, a lot of particulates. And so the lungs face the challenge of being really significant filters. And also, in those particulates come bacteria and viruses and other pathogens. And so the lungs face the challenge of filtering as well as defense. And just the physics of how that particulate-laden air moves into the lungs is very important when we talk about these sorts of lung diseases. Because just like water or fluid with particles, if you take a sample of dirt, and maybe you did this in science class when you were young, put it in a jar with some water, shake it up, and then leave it undisturbed, what will happen is that it will layer out. In the bottom, you'll have the rocks, and then the heavier, larger fragments of earth, and then on top of that, you'll have a layer of fine silt-like clay, and then on top of that, some murky fluid, and then hopefully at the very top, some clear fluid. And this is how air works in the lungs. The largest particles tend to settle out earliest. They're the heaviest, so they end up in the nose and in the back of the throat. Slightly smaller particles settle out in the main stem, bronchus, and the trachea. Smaller particles still settle out in the bronchioles. Now, the very, very smallest particles, the infinitesimal ones, never settle out, and they get breathed back out. But the particles that are about 5 microns across, a little bit smaller, about two-thirds the size of a red blood cell, those are the particles that tend to settle in the small bronchioles just leading out to the alveoli. And in the case of discussions of occupational lung disease and also the sorts of exposures where people are breathing the dust from a volcanic eruption, the 5-micron particles include things like silica, asbestos, carbon, and also, of course, heavy metals if you're talking about a volcanic eruption. But the silica and the carbon are there in the greatest quantities, and those are the ones that create the disease, because all of these types of lung diseases are very dose-dependent. The lungs are superb at dealing with small numbers of particles. It's when the mechanisms of protection become overwhelmed that we get into trouble. The main mechanisms of protection are something called the mucociliary ladder and the macrophages. Those are the two. We'll take the mucociliary ladder first. What you probably didn't know, or maybe you did, is that you have cilia on the linings of those bronchioles, so those hollow tubes I was talking about. They're all lined with little tiny hair cells that are beating all the time, just like the surface of a paramecium. And they're beating in an upwards direction. The mucus gets produced in the bronchioles, and that mucus actually moves on top of the cilia and gets brushed upwards, eventually into the mouth where it's swallowed, and goes down into the stomach where it's bathed in hydrochloric acid and eliminated through the digestive tract. So a lot of the particles that you breathe in actually come out as excrement, which is kind of an interesting thought. More importantly, this mucociliary ladder is very important on the power of the cilia to move. There are people who are born with a syndrome where they don't make mobile cilia, and they also don't make mobile sperm. So this is a condition that causes infertility. But it also leads to a lot of lung problems because these individuals don't have the ability to clear the mucus from their lungs. There's a related disorder called cystic fibrosis, in which the mucus itself doesn't form properly due to an enzymatic barrier. And so the mucus, instead of being thin and very viscous but easy to move, slidey mucus, is actually thick and viscous and doesn't move. And that's cystic fibrosis, with mucus plugs forming. And again, a failure in the mechanism of the mucociliary ladder leads to lots of infections. And the infections usually kill the person and damage their lungs long before the consequences of the other particles would do so. The other important mechanism of defense are macrophages. Macrophages are little amoeba-like cells that float around just under the surface of the skin and also inhabit that mucus. And the macrophages are there to phagocytize, that is to say, to actually envelop all of the particles. And they will envelop particles of carbon, particles of silica, as well as particles of bacteria and particles of asbestos. The asbestosis disease is a very severe, rapidly progressive form of the same sort of disease that you see with coal miners' lungs or silicosis. And all of these are caused by scarring. Effectively, these lead to something called restrictive lung disease, which is quite different from asthma and bronchitis and emphysema, which are obstructive lung diseases. The restrictive part means that the lungs don't expand. Instead of being nice, soft, balloon-like structures that open up and fill with air and then contract, they become stiff and they don't open well. The lungs become tighter. The amount of volume of oxygen that a person can get to the alveoli is severely restricted, like a blocked or partially blocked fuel line. You simply can't get enough oxygen in there, and the lungs can't expand enough to use the still functioning alveoli that are down there at the end of the very smallest branches. Restrictive lung diseases are often occupational, and we've had discussions of coal miners and black lung diseases, but there's also silicosis, which occurs in anyone who works with sandstone or granite, tunnel workers, sandblasters, things like tombstone makers, any kind of mining. And, of course, coal miners have the issue as well. Black lung, which is carbon deposits. There's also beryllium-related diseases, and people will get cotton fibers. There are also a lot of allergic lung diseases, which we're not going to go into because we're just getting too complicated. But in the case of an occupational lung disease, the only protection is a respirator. And while you can regulate, I was having this discussion with a friend the other night, you can regulate the use of respirators. You can insist that people use them, but they're uncomfortable and unpleasant. And if the management of the company is not very insistent that they be used, and again, they impair workers' productivity, so the management has a conflict of interest in terms of looking the other way if people cheat, ultimately, the only people that the workers are cheating are themselves. But if you were listening to NPR earlier this morning, you heard a discussion of people who were taxi drivers who are taking their lives at risk in a very immediate way, working extra hours, traveling into parts of the city they might not otherwise visit because it's a down economy, and they need the money to support their families. People will always make that choice to sacrifice themselves to benefit their families. And, of course, that's what keeps the species going, so I'm glad to see it. But I'm also sorry to see a situation where people have that kind of choice to make. Anyway, didn't mean to end with an editorial comment there. We had an email from Everett in SoCal, who has questions about his mother's digestive problems. He was prompted to write based on a call we had last week regarding ulcerative colitis. And again, in the case of this woman, I don't know her age, but she has nausea, diarrhea, vomiting, heartburn, and had a colonoscopy. Of course, there wasn't anything visibly wrong with her stomach or colon, so she was given some heartburn medications and told to eat healthy. She's continued to lose weight, and Everett's concerned. He's wondering about what to do and where to go now. Well, the first thing, Everett, I would say is that the weight loss in the setting of diarrhea always brings to mind the possibility of malabsorption. There's several places where food gets broken down, and if it isn't broken down properly, then it goes right through you and comes out as diarrhea. The first place is in the stomach. Many older people do not produce enough hydrochloric acid, and as a result, they do not digest food well. They don't start the breakdown process with the enzymes in the stomach that require hydrochloric acid. Furthermore, people who have low levels of hydrochloric acid often have a lot of heartburn. So even though the amount of acid in the stomach is not adequate, they will belch the food back up because they don't empty the stomach. The trigger for stomach emptying is also absent. So one of the things that is very helpful, and it's quite paradoxical, is taking a little acid orally, either in the form of betaine hydrochloride, which you can get at health food stores, or in the form of vinegar. Typically, apple cider vinegar is recommended, but I'm not sure there's any scientific basis for that. The vinegar or the hydrochloric acid pills are enough to help the digestive process get rolling and improve gastric emptying, and people will not have as much belching and heartburn. Very paradoxical, but definitely worth a try. The next thing that happens in the digestive process is the pancreatic enzymes. And again, many older people, particularly if they're diabetic, will not produce adequate amounts of pancreatic enzymes either. And if they don't break down the food products there, they will end up with diarrhea and gas. So that's another place to look. And you can buy pancreatic enzymes at the health food store. I would go with animal-derived enzymes to start, unless someone's a vegan, because the animal-derived ones are stronger. And I just initially trying to see if I affect the diarrhea using these. There are other forms of testing for malabsorption with stool studies, fecal fat, vegetable fibers, etc. You can also test for some of the pancreatic enzymes, like elastase, for example. In general, just a functional trial of pancreatic enzymes can tell you whether or not that makes a difference in the symptoms. The other possibility is food sensitivity testing. That, again, is a, I think, underappreciated cause of chronic digestive issues in people. But if you're seeing weight loss, that really suggests a fairly extreme problem. So I would think that the malabsorption workup should be done first. I hope that's helpful. And I want to thank you all for giving such wonderful email this week. Let's go to Christoph in Santa Cruz. Hello, Christoph. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Hi. Dr. Don.
Hello.
I have a problem with high blood pressure. It started about 3 years ago, and right now the measurement is 161 over 70. And my doctor gave me something also for sleep, which wasn't very good, you know, interrupted in the middle of the night and so. And then she gave me also hydrochlorothiazide, mm-hmm. and added a third one, now, which is called lisinopril.
What was the first medicine? I missed the first one.
The first one was mirtazapine, which is for better sleep.
Okay, got it. All right. And so, how old are you?
77.
77. And had you been to the doctor in the last year prior to this visit?
Yeah, I just saw my doctor a few days ago.
I'm wondering about before that, before these drugs were started, how long have you had the high blood pressure is really my question.
You know, I had it the first time about 5 years ago. Like it went up and down, and it changed very much in value.
Yes.
And lately it's more constant, and right now it's at 161, you know, systolic pressure, which is worrisome.
Yes, it is. And what we call that is isolated systolic hypertension. It's very, very common as one ages for the arteries to become less flexible. That has to do with the deposition of small amounts of plaque and also with a decrease in the amount of nitric oxide production in the endothelial cells, which are the linings of the arteries. The combination of these two things leads to a tightening of the structure of all of the arteries in your body. And so when the heart beats, that surge of blood that goes through causes a high systolic, but then the lower pressure is normal. The diastolic is normal.
Yeah.
When the systolic gets above 160, there's a very steep increase in the frequency of strokes in particular. Heart disease as well, heart attacks, but strokes really go up very precipitously above 160.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that it was fluctuating before and then sort of stabilized with a high systolic is absolutely classic for how this particular form of hypertension develops. So you're right out of the textbook. And that's because initially the production of nitric oxide in the cells is unstable. So sometimes it's good and the blood pressure's okay, but then sometimes it's bad. And particularly when the person's upset or excited, their blood pressures will go up, the so-called white coat hypertension. And I read a lot in standard medical literature that white coat hypertension is not a disease, that we don't need to do anything about it. We don't need to give people blood pressure medications for this. And while I agree that we don't need to use pharmaceuticals for it, I disagree that it's not a disease. I see this as a pre-disease. And I have not seen a study, but I would be willing to bet, based on the physiology, that people with white coat hypertension, so-called, within 10 years, go on to have plain old garden variety, constant high blood pressure, because that's how this physiology breaks down over time. Now, in your case, you're on a diuretic, and it's a potassium-depleting diuretic. And you're on lisinopril, which was added an angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitor, and it acts to relax the blood vessels, and it also has an effect in the kidney that causes the kidney to retain potassium. So that's good because it helps balance the potassium-depleting effects of the hydrochlorothiazide. But you do need to be careful to avoid taking potassium supplements. And some of the salt substitutes that you might buy over the counter have potassium in them. So it is important to not start one of those without getting a blood test for potassium, assuming you need to be on this long term.
Yeah, I don't take these at all, and I take no soy sauce, nothing.
Okay, but you are 71 years old, so you've
77.
Gotten 77. So you've gotten to the point where living right may not be enough to keep the things entirely safe. Now, let me tell you some natural things that can help with high blood pressure. I don't know if there will be enough in your case. You've already stated that you don't want to take these pills and you're not taking them, right?
I'm taking them right now.
Okay. I thought you just said you weren't. My mistake.
No, I want to get rid of them if I can.
Though, let me give you some hints for that, okay?
Yeah.
Hint number one is you need to eat 7 to 9 servings of fruits and vegetables a day.
Yeah.
All right, 7 to 9 is a lot. A serving is a half a cup of chopped or cooked vegetables, or equivalent of a half a cup of fruit. So a small apple is a serving. A very large orange might count as one and a half or two servings. But the half cup is a good general measure.
I do that already. I've been reading this book about high blood pressure and how important potassium is.
That's correct. Potassium is extremely important.
Yeah.
But you can't go taking extra potassium if you're taking lisinopril. You could get yourself in trouble. So the place that I use potassium is earlier, before I start the drugs. The other thing that's extremely important is magnesium. And it would be safe for you to take magnesium supplements while on lisinopril.
Mm-hmm.
That would not create a risk. And magnesium has a natural relaxing effect on the blood vessels. And it's possible to take very large doses of magnesium if you split it up throughout the day. Your body will not absorb more magnesium than it can handle, and instead you'll get diarrhea from it.
Yeah. About how much magnesium?
I usually suggest to people that they use magnesium glycinate, G-L-Y-C-I-N.
Glycinate?
G-L-Y-C-I-N.
Yeah.
Okay, glycinate. 150 to 300 milligrams, three times a day. And that's a kind of a minimum dose. But you can continue to take more. Basically, whatever doesn't give you diarrhea is fine. And at high doses of magnesium in the 1,000 to 2,000 milligram level, I have been able to see people's blood pressure drop enough that we've been able to stop medications.
Mm-hmm.
So magnesium is very important. Calcium is very important.
How much calcium?
A lot. If you're drinking fluids and staying hydrated, easily 1,000 milligrams a day is fine.
Yeah.
More than 1,500 might cause a kidney stone. At your age, I wouldn't want to risk that. But 1,000 milligrams, assuming normal kidney function, and I assume that because you haven't told me otherwise, but your doctor would be able to tell you if you have any impaired kidney function.
Mm-hmm.
All right. The other thing is omega-3 fatty acids at fairly high doses.
Yeah, I have that. About how much of that?
Well, if you look on the back and look at the amount of EPA and DHA, and get that up to about 2,000 milligrams.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the sweet spot in terms of not being so much that it interferes with blood clotting, but being enough that you get the benefit.
Mm-hmm.
That might be 6 to 8 capsules of standard fish oil supplement.
Yeah.
And you do need to be careful. I would suggest going to the links on the Ask Dr. Don website about which fish oil supplements should be avoided, because there are some issues right now in terms of dioxin contamination.
Mm-hmm.
And also, there are links to sites. There's a national fish oil website that's got very good information about this.
There is a store in Watsonville, which is called Nordic Naturals.
Yes.
If I buy my fish oil there, would that be safe?
I think that they are one of the highest quality products in the country. So yes, I think that would be just fine.
Okay.
All right?
Yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah. So what's your guess about how long might I have to labor at until I can drop the lisinopril?
The first thing to do is do all of these things for about 2 to 3 months.
Uh-huh.
And then monitor your blood pressure at home.
Yeah.
When you ask to drop the lisinopril, you need to have good normal blood pressures across the board before you do it. Mm-hmm. So if you're doing all of these things for 3 months and you're still running a diastolic of 155 or 150, then the chances of success are low.
Mm-hmm.
You really do have to get the blood pressure to normal before you withdraw the drugs.
Which is normal for my age?
Well, ideally, I would want you under 135, but certainly under 140 before you stop the drug.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
Good luck.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Call us back and let us know how it goes.
Yeah.
Bye-bye. We have time for one more caller. We'll go to Ed in Paso Robles.
Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
Question about high blood pressure. I'm not quite as old as the previous caller. I'm about 70 and a half, and I'm on 2.5 milligrams of lisinopril. In the mornings, when I get up, I have high like 150 or plus. And then as the day goes on, and especially with exercise, it drops it usually drops down to the normal range, about 120, and if I exercise very vigorously, it'll drop below that.
What's the diastolic number?
Gee whiz, you would ask something like that.
Well, let me have you ballpark it. 70s, 80s, 90s?
In that range.
Pick one.
this morning it was 76, 77, 76.
All right. So in the 70s, 150s over 70s is different than 150 over 90s, is why,
right.
why I'm asking.
One morning it was 109, after I exercised on the treadmill, it was 109 over 98.
Okay, so this is good, because I would infer from the fact that your blood pressure improves with exercise that you've still got nice flexible blood vessels. So the first thing I would suggest you do is, you know, we expect the blood pressure to be high first thing in the morning because there's more adrenaline in the system to kind of wake you up and more cortisol, and that's a normal biorhythm phenomenon. People, as they deteriorate, start to run a more stable blood pressure. Ironically, stability in nature is usually a bad thing. Of course, the most stable situation of all is to be dead. But variability in your heart rate, as we talked about earlier, heterogeneity in your bone microstructure, instability and flexibility kind of go together, and flexibility is what keeps you alive. So the first thing I would say is that the fact that it changes is good. I'm not so worried that it's 150. That's a tolerable pressure, and with a little bit of atherogenesis, just globally hardening of the arteries at 70 and a half, that may be inevitable, and I don't see at that number, 150, that it's much of a risk for you.
It seems to be higher on an empty stomach, put that way.
Well, have you tried using magnesium? Because that is one of those no-brainer sorts of interventions, and they increase the fruits and vegetables in the diet. Have you done those things?
You mentioned that to the previous caller, and I will try that.
Yeah.
I take a small amount of it, but I should probably increase the dosage.
Try taking a lot. I think that in early and mild hypertension, we could probably reduce or even eliminate a lot of medications if we just used magnesium as a first-line therapy. But it's an afterthought or not even on the event horizon for most people, most physicians, and that's a shame. So using magnesium at fairly high doses, maximum tolerated, doing the fruits and vegetables, doing the high-dose omega-3 fatty acids, those are sort of the first-line things. Sometimes I will have people take an amino acid called L-arginine. You would be one of the people, because of the variability that you're showing, that might be less likely to benefit from that, but it would still be worth a try. And amino acid therapy doses are typically 3,000, 4,000 milligrams of an amino acid in one dose a day, usually people will tolerate. And I have a lot of success with those natural therapies first. And then from there, I'll go to diuretics, and I typically will use a diuretic called spironolactone first, because that has a better track record in hypertension, actually, than hydrochlorothiazide. The problem with spironolactone is that you can't take that with lisinopril or any of the angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors, because you will get too much potassium in the bloodstream if you mix those two. So if it's not working, I have to pull it and reorient, so to speak. But because it works a lot of the time and I don't have to go further, I just warn people there are certain drugs you can't add to this. Make sure that the doctor knows you're taking it, et cetera, et cetera, and leave it at that. So I hope that's been helpful. We're going to have to close out the show, though, because we've come to the end of our time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to Ask Dr. Don, and I hope that you will make use of that resource, askdrdon.com, and that's a great place to send suggestions or email your questions. This is Dr. Don saying so long, and stay healthy.